This is BBC Radio 4. In the early 19th century, a celebrated British physicist turned his mind to the invention of a brand new musical instrument. Now Bernard Richardson looks at how his professional predecessor not only succeeded in creating his musical instrument, but in finding a champion to take it to the dizzy heights of virtuosity and popularity. Wheatstone, his sighing reed, and the great Rigondi.
There are those who desire to enjoy music socially, to play together, to explore the riches of concerted chamber music. They are too old to learn to fiddle, or, having learnt, cannot do it well enough to produce a tolerable concord. Their difficulty is, fortunately, quite easy to solve. The instrument for them is the concertina.
So, just how do you invent a new musical instrument? Now, I'm a physicist and a musician, and I've spent many years investigating how instruments work. The traditional wind and stringed instruments have developed over a very long period of time. But the concertina is very different. It's an invention. And its inventor was one of my professional forebears, the great Victorian physicist and engineer, Charles Wheatstone. Wheatstone was a really amazing figure. Like me, he had a particular interest in musical acoustics, but his name lives on through an invention called the Wheatstone Bridge, which measures electrical resistance. And of course, for the work that he did along with William Cooke, on the development of the telegraph. For all his inventiveness, Wheatstone was a rather shy man, so he left it to his great friend, the physicist Michael Faraday, to deliver a lecture to the Royal Institution on the application of a new principle in the construction of musical instruments. In other words, to demonstrate the working of fixed springs or free reeds.
The concept of a free reed instrument is basically this. It's an instrument with metal reeds, and unlike an oboe, for instance, or a clarinet, where the player is actually coming into contact with the reed, that doesn't happen on a free reed instrument.
Alan Atlas is director of the Center for the Study of Free Reed Instruments at Brooklyn College, New York.
The metal reeds are in the innards of the instrument, if you will. They're inside the instrument, and either by blowing into the instrument, as on a harmonica, or by using bellows, as on the concertina and the accordion, that sets off a stream of air within the instrument. And the air passes over the metal reed, makes the reed start vibrating, and that's what sets off the sound of the instrument. So the player and the metal reed never come into contact with one another. The second quarter of the 19th century was a period of what somebody once described as free reed mania, or free reed frenzy. Between around 1825 and the early 1840s, we see the invention of one, the harmonica, two, the accordion, three, the concertina, four, the harmonium, and any number of other instruments, the bandoneon that eventually became so famous with the tango musicians. Exactly what kicked off this free reed frenzy is a little bit difficult to say. We do know the following, that back in the late 1780s, there was an exhibition in Paris at which a Chinese instrument called the sheng was exhibited. The sheng is a free reed instrument. It has metal reeds with bamboo shoots coming up out of the top of the instrument. Whether that was the main incentive that kicked off all this developing of free reed instruments is hard to say, but that's certainly one of the things that contributed.
Alan Atlas. That Wheatstone should have applied his scientific background to the production of musical instruments is not surprising. His family were musical instrument makers, music publishers, and teachers. His early experiments into the physics of musical instruments are fascinating, and surely they paved the way for his important work in telegraphy. He gave a public demonstration of his acucryptophone, or enchanted lyre. A harp was suspended by a thin piece of wire from a soundboard of a piano in the room above. As the piano was played, the wire conveyed the vibrations from the piano to the harp, making it sound as if the harp itself was being played. Prophetically, he speculated that transmitted sound would be the way of the future. Neil Wayne is a researcher and collector of Wheatstone concertinas. His collection of nearly 700 concertinas is now housed at the Horniman Museum in London.
In the remains of the Wheatstone Museum that were cleared away in the 1920s, I found organ pipes with pressure gauges at various points, a violin-shaped instrument with metal reeds as strings with bellows either side. Amazing things. He was tinkering away. Yeah. He made a concertina that you pedalled with your feet, and wind came up a column, and two ends of a concertina were on a bench affair that you'd play. He made one. He patented it. He never made another.
Isn't that rather like a harmonium, though? What a harmonium is? It's like the same principle as the concertina, but pedalled from the fifth to the keyboard.
There was a community of inventors across Europe, Debain and Demion in France, inventing various foot-powered harmoniums, early organs, reed organs, and I think Wheatstone must have kept an eye on this, and there's a couple of Wheatstone-made harmoniums, including one, again a prototype, that instead of working on reeds, works on a stretched gut string, and every time you press a key, various lengths of this gut string are fretted off and then sucked across an aperture and set into vibration.
So like an aeolian harp.
Yes,
or
totally.
Like that.
Or a hurdy-gurdy, yes. You know. Very, very strange things.
Now, as a physicist, you see, I know Wheatstone's name from this cunning bit of circuitry to measure resistance called the Wheatstone Bridge.
Yes.
But I've discovered that Wheatstone didn't invent the Wheatstone Bridge.
He explained the Wheatstone Bridge and did invent the concertina, because in 1829 he patented this little instrument here called the symphonium. Mm-hmm. It's a mouth-blown variant.
It was a large matchbox size,
yes,
isn't it?
With some buttons down the side. Yes. Yeah, and gold reeds, incidentally.
Yeah, but there's no bellows here, are there?
No, the bellows are in my chest and this one.
So you blow into it. Neil Wayne. Wheatstone's concertina is known as the English concertina, and it's important to know this, especially for your concertina player, because there are at least two later variants. Best known of these are the confusingly named Anglo concertina, which in fact is German in origin, and the duet, both of which have different fingering patterns from Wheatstone's English concertina. So if you've learnt on one, you can't just pick up another and play it. Brian Bowers is Wheatstone's biographer.
Wheatstone's key invention was the arrangement of the keys. Mm. On a concertina, where there are buttons you press to switch the wind to different reeds, the buttons are quite close together, and they are so arranged that if you press two adjacent buttons simultaneously, you get a chord rather than a discord. If on the piano you press two adjacent keys,
you get a discord.
You get an unpleasant noise.
Do we know whether Wheatstone actually played his concertinas?
I find it inconceivable that with all those concertinas lying around, Wheatstone didn't have a go. You know, he must have played it.
Do you think that the physicist mindset that he had, the engineer's mindset, helped to produce a very good arrangement of keys, which was musically beneficial? Or was it more by chance, do you think?
I think he was quite practically minded. In his telegraphs, he was trying to make instruments that were easy to operate. I'm sure that when he picked up a musical instrument in the family workshop, he would say to himself, now, how can I make this a bit easier? If I rearrange the keys like this, it might be easier to play.
Yes, because to play a scale, you play left, right, don't you? So in effect, you can effectively play quite quickly.
Yes.
And as you say, if you happen to push two buttons, adjacent buttons together, then in fact you get a pleasant sound rather than a discordant sound.
That was his idea, yes.
So yes, it does sound like it's an application of logic rather than anything else.
Yes, I think Wheatstone was an applier of ideas rather than an originator of original ideas.
Yes, he's a modern engineer rather than a pure scientist, I guess.
Yes, he really was an engineer, yes.
So, this is the English concertina, invented by Sir Charles Wheatstone.
Alistair Anderson is an internationally recognised master of the English concertina.
The scale goes from hand to hand. So it starts on the left, and then it goes to the right, and it goes to the left, to the right, left, right, all the way up. There are four rows of buttons on either side, and the two central rows are like white notes on the piano. The outside ones are the sharps and flats. And it just sort of zigzags up one side. So on one side it's going one, three, five. Okay, so it's one, left, two, three, four, five. So on one side, it's one, three, five. So you get a little chord by making in little triangles since it's zigzagging up. So there's a certain logic to it. It also means that in 4 inches, I've got 4 octaves. Not that I play up there very often because it's very, very high. But because the scale is split between the two hands, it is very small and compact. And also, actually, there are not many times when you have to worry too much about fingering. You know, if you went to an accordion workshop, there will be lots of conversation about, to play that phrase, it's better to bring the thumb first and then the second finger and what have you. I do that sort of thing, you know, once or twice a year I have to sing a particular tune because you've got 6 fingers to play the tunes. So it's the actual layout is quite nice. Now, in terms of volume and colour, you can just play that gently, just by gently pulling on the bellows or pushing on the bellows. You get the same note on the English concertina, whichever way the bellows are going. Or you can increase that pressure. You can decrease that pressure. And the more you can develop a vocabulary of shades, it just allows, you know, for more expressive playing.
It's quite difficult to think of actually building a new musical instrument, isn't it? When you think of the musical instruments you have in the orchestra, we have strings which generate sounds, we have air columns which generate sounds, or we have metal plates or drum skins or whatever in the percussion section. But what is it that makes a musical instrument suddenly come into prominence and be accepted by society?
I suppose you must have a good musician who takes to the instrument, can perform and draw an audience.
Yeah, and inspire people, I guess.
Yes.
And who was this for Wheatstone and his concertina?
Well, the well-known name, of course, is Giulio Rigondi.
Part of Giulio Rigondi's Serenade in A, played here by Douglas Rogers. Like Rigondi, Douglas's first instrument was the guitar, and he was looking to fill a gap in its repertoire of those romantic works which great player-composers like Chopin, Liszt and Paganini had written to show off their own abilities. He felt that the answer may have laid with Rigondi.
I went along to the British Library, and there in the catalogue were about 4 or 5 pages of his works. But they weren't for the guitar. What was going on? I think it was about 1 or 2 for the guitar. It was all for concertina. And like everyone else who doesn't know the instrument, I thought, well, ridiculous, a tiny, silly barge sailor instrument, you know, not to be taken seriously. What the heck was this great figure of Victorian music doing? And I looked at the music and I found immediately, not only the guitar music, but also the concertina music, that was full of the kind of effects and sounds and look that I expected from, say, Chopin, that sort of romantic era. So I then found myself a concertina, which wasn't actually all that easy. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the tuning system, the fingering system, whether there were lots of different sorts of concertinas. How do you start? And I began to copy out by hand a lot of the tutors. And there were plenty of them. I mean, this instrument's taken pretty seriously. There were tutors full of scales in every key and sixths and octaves and tenths and proper studies. Much more rigorous, actually, and much more eclectic in the repertoire than anything ever found in the guitar. That was strange for a start. So I copied these things out, got the instrument, and then started day one, page one, how to play this.
So who was Giulio Regondi? Douglas Rogers again.
He's a bit of a mystery figure, and he was in his own time as well. But he seems to have been born in 1822 in Geneva. But he had a German mother and an Italian father, and his mother died in childbirth. And from then on, he seemed to have been taken in hand by the father. But the father seems to have been a stepfather or an uncle. And the name of the father was Giuseppe Regondi. May have given the name to Giulio himself. We don't really know. But there are vignettes of his early life, the fact he was forced to practice. And indeed, he seemed to have been performing on the guitar, which was his main instrument, from about the age of four, about 1826, and exhibited he was at the various royal courts of Europe. But by the time he came over to this country in 1831, same year as Paganini, he was as good, it seemed, as many of the adult professors of the guitar. And he was very successful in this country. He went round lionized and petted by all society, and he seems to have settled down here. Apparently the father was asked by Wheatstone if he knew of anyone who might be able to show off the instrument. Of course, that was a pretty calculated question, I reckon, because he'd obviously spotted the potential in this young chap, who was full of musical genius as a performer, and young enough to be able to take up this new instrument and become a great ambassador. And Regondi received his first lesson at the Wheatstone shop in Conduit Street. But in a way, the important introduction of the concertina to the public was its performance by him at the Birmingham Music Festival in 1837 under the direction of Mendelssohn.
In 1861, the Brighton Gazette declared that a greater genius than Regondi as an instrumentalist never lived. A quite astonishing claim when you think that Paganini was still very much in the public consciousness.
Signor Regondi has now brought his execution on the concertina to such perfection that it's probably impossible to go beyond him. He has attained such wonderful dexterity. His command over his instrument is so great that it seems a mere plaything in his hands. But therein does not lie his greatest merit, since other players, with sufficient care and practice, might hope to arrive at similar mechanical excellence. That which raises Signor Regondi above other performers is the sentiment and expression by which he assimilates his instrument to the human voice, and sings in a manner to rival the effects obtained by the greatest singers. The cantabile passages remind us, by their breadth of tone and deep feeling, of Rubini, Paganini, or Ernst in similar passages on the violin.
Wheatstone's calculation that his new instrument would need its champion was bearing fruit. Regondi was a darling of the society salons and concert halls, and Wheatstone's marketing strategy was to target the wealthy upper classes and aristocracy who lionized him. Alan Atlas.
One could actually keep very, very careful track, meticulously so, of the fortunes, if you will, of the Wheatstone Company in terms of their concertina manufacturing and sales, because we're fortunate enough to have buried in the basement of the Horniman Museum 9 extant sales ledgers that basically record the day-to-day sales of their concertinas by the Wheatstone Company from around the middle of 1835 to approximately 1870. It's amazing to see how sales climb. Over the course of those 35 years, the Wheatstone and Company sales ledgers record something like 13,000 transactions. It's an incredible sociological story to go through the sales ledgers, as I have, and see who some of their customers were. They were selling concertinas to dukes and earls and duchesses and countesses. There's the Duke of Newcastle. He bought a concertina. There's the Archbishop of Canterbury, who bought one around 1850. One customer in the Wheatstone's shop was Arthur Balfour, who eventually became a prime minister. He was an ardent concertina player. So you get a picture of the Wheatstone English concertina. You get an idea of the market at which Wheatstone was aiming.
So here at the Horniman Museum in London, they have a vast display of different types of concertina. to my eye, they all look rather similar. But can you see Wheatstone's physicist's eye or engineer's eye in the way that he's designed the layout of the keys?
Well, this is a Wheatstone-style instrument from about 1850. You'll see it's hexagonal, and that is logical because you can get quite a lot of parts within a hexagon in terms of levers and valves without having too many joins at the corners. Make it square and you waste space. Make it octagonal and you have too many joins. Mm-hmm. So there's a good idea for a start. Similarly, when we look inside, you'll notice that each...
Yes, now you've just taken the top off this.
Yes.
And the outer casing is made from wood with some fretwork here, obviously to let the sound out.
Yes.
And then the buttons. And then underneath I can see the arrangement of reeds.
Yes.
But
see,
what is it which activates each reed?
Then? There we are. Then if I press this button, you'll see the pad underneath the piece of wood that's got all the buttons on it will lift up.
So it's opening a little valve, isn't it?
A little valve.
And that's what lets the air in then.
So if then you're moving the bellows outwards, the partial vacuum within the bellows allows air to rush in through the pad into this chamber, and I'm blowing as if I'm...
Sure, you're blowing through the reed itself now. Yeah.
And if I pull the bellows out, then it plays the other way.
Someday someone's going to invent a collective noun for the sounds of all these people trying out all these concertinas.
And all these people were gathered at Whitney in Oxfordshire for a hands-on concertina weekend. A sort of concertina jamboree in which players of all ages and abilities shared their joy of the instrument and attended masterclasses. Jenny Cox was one of the tutors.
One of the things it does show, of course, that Wheatstone was making the bigger instruments, basses and baritones, which allowed for part music, by the middle of the 19th century. And we have records of a quartet that went round playing in posh places, like the Red Drawing Room of Windsor Castle, for example, on basses and baritones and trebles.
Rigondi's influence was immense in the polite London society that still bought fine Wheatstones to play in ensembles and groups. Once the concertina began to be a second-hand instrument and find its way, in the words of one critic, into the hands of street boys, then the posh end of the market tended to drop it a little. But its social migration, a bit of a cliche, meant that there was a welcoming of the instrument in working class men who played together in concertina bands, especially in the north of England. They couldn't afford brass instruments, but concertinas, well, they're the same, aren't they? Mm. Wheatstone then made specially deep instruments to mimic tubas and euphoniums. It made piccolo instruments for flutes and whatever. And also the Salvation Army, perhaps at the late 1880s, 1890s, took it up. It was a recognisable instrument.
Come and have a look at this one. This is a deeply extraordinary bass because most of them only work one way because the length of the reeds is several inches at the bottom. But this actually has got double reeds because on this system you push and pull and you get the same note. So to have two sets of reeds like that, and it's a beautiful instrument.
Dave Townsend is the organiser of concertinas at Whitney.
In the 1890s, I would say you could probably say that the concertina was as popular as the electric guitar is today. It was the instrument that everybody played. Everybody carried it around. In the First World War, enormous numbers of soldiers must have taken their concertinas to the front with them, and we know this was happening. Immediately after the First World War, again, people were still developing and inventing and making refinements on the design of the concertina. So it was very, very much alive until the piano accordion arrived, and really that was the big difference. If you could play the piano, you could pick up a piano accordion, you could get a tune out of it, and piano accordions were loud. Now, I think one of the reasons the concertina went into the background, really, was because music was getting louder then. If you think about the big bands, you know, full drum kit and everything else, the size of dance halls, and then amplification, instruments had to be loud, and the piano recording was quite simply loud. The concertina still carried on being played, there were still specialists, but it never had that kind of popularity. There's a continuing thread of playing that went through certainly into the 1950s when the International Concertina Association was founded. Of course, within a very short while, the folk revival happened of the 1960s. Suddenly there was an interest in the concertina from a completely different direction.
Not even the Rigondi aficionados would argue that the classical concertina has been well and truly hijacked by the folk fraternity, but purists should take comfort in the fact that it is at least being kept alive. And here's something else to cling on to. Traditional Northumbrian concertina master Alistair Anderson is working with a Lindsay string quartet on new music embracing both traditions.
I've worked with classical musicians finding a space between traditional music and classical music. The Lindsay String Quartet commissioned me to write a piece called On Cheviot Hills, and they wanted something which would give them and their audience an insight into traditional music. So it's pretty obvious that, you know, there are melodies which are either slow airs or dance-orientated melodies, and I worked very hard to get them to take those tunes on the sort of journey that I would take a tune like that on. Not to try and play in traditional style, but to have that same sense of ownership. And that, indeed, I had to say to them, look, if it ends up slightly differently to the way it is in my head, I mean, not the notes, but the phrasing, that's fine. And that sort of worried them for a second. But that, then we got into that, and that was very exciting.
Rigondi died at the age of 49 in 1872, just 3 years before Sir Charles Wheatstone. Whether the two actually ever met is not recorded, although it seems inconceivable that their paths never crossed. Wheatstone's name lived on through his inventions, whereas Rigondi's more or less died with him, probably because his music is too fiendishly difficult for anyone else to play. But there is hope. Douglas Rogers.
It'd be great to find someone young with talent, as indeed Rigondi, and introduce them to the great possibilities of concertina, to play those forgotten great pieces, big concert works, opus works, and also to inspire and bring out new pieces and new works. That is the potential of the instrument.
Wheatstone, his sighing reed, and the great Rigondi was presented by Bernard Richardson and produced in Wales by Paul Evans.